Okay, you are listening to Green Left Radio. And for our first guest of the program this week, we are speaking to Stuart Monckton, who is a longtime activist who has an interest in Irish republicanism and has also regularly kind of written on it. He recently wrote a piece for Green Left titled Bloody Sunday, 50 Years On, and a Symbol of Ongoing Injustice, and has written for other left-wing publications such as Green Left and Irish Broad Left, and among others. So, yeah, good morning, Stuart.
Good morning.
Okay, well, I guess to start off with the first kind of question, Bloody Sunday was a massacre on the 30th of January 1972, which involved British soldiers shooting over 26 unarmed civilians during a protest march in the Bogside area of Derry. And, of course, it has been 50 years since that historical kind of event. And what can you, I guess, tell us about Bloody Sunday and its historical significance? And what does it reveal about the evils of the British state and its continued occupation of Ireland?
Well, I mean, it was a very decisive event in what was known as the Troubles. I mean, on the day itself, it was a demonstration. It was an illegal demonstration. It had been banned by the authorities, that was protesting the policy of internment by which British forces would just lift off the streets anyone who they accused of links to Republican groups, particularly the IRA. And they, through that policy, I mean, almost 2,000 people have got picked up overwhelmingly from the nationalist community, most with no links whatsoever to armed groups, and torture was very widespread. And so it was organised by the Northern Irish Civil Rights Association, which had been, since 1966, pushing for civil liberties and equality in Northern Ireland, which is a very, very sectarian state in which the Catholic minority, overwhelmingly nationalists, faced extreme discrimination. And they went ahead with the demonstration despite it being banned, and the numbers of people vary, but there's probably at least 15,000 people on the streets. And towards the end of the march, there'd been some clashes with teenagers who, you know, threw rocks, and police threw, and the army responded with tear gas and the like, and then unexpectedly began firing and fired for, you know, 15 minutes. Pretty much straight. Those who were shot were largely fleeing, many were shot from behind, and others were shot whilst tending to the wounded, and the result was 13 died, and a 14th later died. And I mean, obviously this event caused widespread outrage, you know, across Ireland. When mentioned in my article, sparked the largest general strike by head of population in Europe since World War II, occurred in the Republic of Ireland, during which the British embassy in Dublin got burnt down. And the response to this atrocity of the British was immediately to cover up and lie. And I mean, it's sort of well known, things like the Widgery Report, which I think began 2 days after the event and took about 10 weeks to complete it, and completely exonerated the British soldiers and claimed that they accepted their defence, that it was self-defence, that they had in fact been fired on, which is a thoroughly now completely discredited claim. But it's also important to note, it's not just the official, you know, judicial response. You need to look at the response of the British you know, establishment, and in general, if you look at, for example, the media reporting, and some of this is in, there was a Jacobin article about it, also published to mark the 50th anniversary, that goes through the media response, right from the sort of more, you know, conservative papers such as the Daily Telegraph, whose response is probably exactly what you'd expect, through to the Guardian, and the Guardian entirely blamed the demonstrators as well. You know, and essentially said they brought the shooting on themselves. Now, and I think the fact that after the families for justice and a solidarity, you know, movement raising the issue of Bloody Sunday, that they finally, the Seville inquiry that was began in 1998, by the time it finally finished and was released in 2010, completely obliterated the slander that that soldiers had been fired on, and established that it was in fact an unprovoked massacre. And the British Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, even apologised. Nonetheless, there's still been no prosecution of any of the soldiers. There was one who was charged in the aftermath of that inquiry, and that was dropped last year because they said that you know, statements from 1972 couldn't be considered admissible anymore.
You mentioned in your article that there were some acts of resistance or response from the Irish in response to the massacre. And now you already mentioned the general strike and the burning of the embassy in Dublin. Could you give other examples of the Irish kind of the responses to the Bloody Sunday massacre on behalf of the Irish?
Look, in order to understand this, it has to be understood as the events of Bloody Sunday, both, you know, the fact that it was firing on an illegal a large mass illegal demonstration, and the nature of the atrocity have to be understood as one of the events, a very decisive event in a phase of very violent oppression and resistance itself. And it's important to place Bloody Sunday as it was a turning point in an ongoing process of oppression and resistance occurring in Northern Ireland. So the unit that committed it, the Parachute Regiment, I mean, they had previously been in West Belfast when internment was first introduced in August of 1971, and they committed a massacre in the working-class nationalist area of Ballymurphy, where they set up a free fire zone for 3 days, where they would shoot anything on the streets that moved. And they killed 11 people. And again, many were shot. You know, there was a case of a mother on the street trying to get her children inside, shot in the head. Again, shot, you know, a priest was shot while trying to to attend to someone else who'd been shot. And so it really has to be placed in that context. There had been the very fact that there were British soldiers and the very fact that a massacre like Bloody Sunday happened occurred after, 6 years really into the civil rights struggle that began and immediately faced extreme violence by the Northern Irish authorities, by the Royal Ulster Confederacy, the police force, the B Specials, a sort of militarised auxiliary force, and Protestant gangs. And that itself sparked huge resistance. It had to. I mean, if you understand the context of what was happening, you saw pogroms against Catholics. You saw them being driven in their thousands from their homes, driven from jobs. And there was the largest forced movement of people anywhere since World War II, anywhere in Europe. Thousands of people fled into the largely Catholic areas, and they had to defend them with barricades, petrol bombs and rocks. They created basically liberated zones, and they had to defend them constantly from violence. And, of course, most famously that occurred in Derry in the Battle of the Bogside in 1969. They created the Free Derry Liberated Zone. And on Bloody Sunday, on that day, in 1972, there were still places that the British Army were not safe to go. There were no-go zones for the British Army. And the British Army came in initially, said that we're going to be peacekeepers. There's too much unrest going on. You know, the Catholics are under attack. And many in the Catholic community initially supported the troops going there because they thought it would protect them from the Royal Ulster Constabulary and these Protestant Protestant gangs that were committing constant acts of terror against them. What happened on Bloody Sunday has to be understood as a response to resistance. It was the policy of internment was a response to resistance. And it was really an attempt to try and change the things on the ground in Derry so that the British Army could go where they wanted. And the most decisive thing about Bloody Sunday was that particularly when it came as an escalation of all this violence, which we saw then in Ballymurphy and then in Derry, it was a complete militarisation of what had been a civil struggle, a civil rights struggle. There was no way forward for many in the nationalist community that they could see if we can't even march in the streets without getting shot dead. That the only way to respond to that was the armed struggle that the Provisional IRA and other armed groups were carrying out. So it had a very militarising effect on the entire struggle.
Hmm. And yeah, I think that you present that kind of like presents a kind of very good kind of summary, I guess, of because often there's often this sort of one-sided kind of take, you know, that you often kind of hear from what kind of more sort of liberal sort of takes on the sort of Irish sort of struggle, where you know there's often this sort of blanket sort of condemnation of the violence of the RRA, and it's never put into any sort of context. And I think you gave a kind of very good contextual explanation for that.
Well, you have to look seriously at it in the sense of the policy of internment. I mean, they just go and pick up young working class men and women. You know, and the story is repeated again and again from the people who were interned. You know, young guys going, like, I was 18 years old, I wanted to get drunk, play football, you know, chase girls. I had no political thought in my head. They picked me up, they tortured me. I went out, and the first thing I did was seek the IRA recruiting sergeant. It caused the mass support and for the IRA that existed and was the reason why they could never be defeated. All sides in that conflict committed crimes, and that's acknowledged by the Republican movement today. But there's no question that the IRA enjoyed serious popular support in the nationalist communities because it was seen as their defence and the ones fighting for them against what had been a totally one-sided terror, of which Bloody Sunday is very emblematic.
Hmm. And I guess you argue in your article, this goes into the next point, which is you argue in your article that the roots of the violence go back to the 1922 Partition of Ireland. And I guess just what can you tell us about that history, I guess, for our listeners' information who may not be as conscious about that kind of historical kind of context?
Yeah, well, definitely, because it was established when the Irish War of Independence, when there was the treaty that ended that conflict gave, well, it was initially home rule, but basically gave independence to most of Ireland. 32 counties in Ireland, 26 formed the Irish Free State, which became the Irish Republic. But the British sort of enforced on, and it's a very controversial thing in Irish history, whether or not the Irish side was right to accept the leadership was right to accept the treaty or not. But the point is, the British really did what they could to force it on it, and it carved out six counties in Ulster. But Ulster's nine counties in the north. Ulster's ultimately nine counties. They only took six, and they did that in order to manufacture a Protestant majority over the Catholic minority, because the Protestant population in Ulster tended to be more supportive of British rule, known as the Unionists, and the Catholics were overwhelmingly nationalist. And to establish that state, they did it as an extraordinarily sectarian state, to such an extent that when the architects of South African apartheid explicitly pointed to Northern Ireland as one of their models. And so it was extreme discrimination. You had factories, you know, thousands of workers in these factories. Not a single one would be Catholic. There was a policy of you just don't hire Catholics. You know, so there was extreme discrimination in housing, extreme discrimination in jobs, in education funding, in pretty much every measure, including democracy. There was very little democracy. So they gerrymandered the situations to basically deny one person one vote. Instead, it was tied up with property rights. You had to own the vote. You had to sort of own your house. So the inequality in housing then also became a massive political inequality. And that was especially the case in a place like Derry, because Derry actually had a majority of Catholics, and yet they had no political power because the situation was rigged. They couldn't, you know, like, despite numerically being the majority, they didn't have enough electoral rights to actually have that reflected in the institutions. And that's what started. And the civil rights movement that started in the late 60s, from 66 on, explicitly modeled itself in the US civil rights movement. And, you know, they sung the same songs. You can see footage of them saying, we shall overcome. And that was not a Republican movement. There were Republicans in it. Many in the nationalist community were Republicans, but it wasn't seeking a united Ireland. It was seeking democratic and civil rights within the existing state. And really, Bloody Sunday was the final nail in the coffin of that for the nationalist community, that there's clearly no way forward in that way. And it became, you know, both a, you know, like a Republican struggle overwhelmingly, but and then of course you had the armed dimension of it due really to the nature of the occupation. So the British soldiers were there. That's what they were defending. They were defending this extremely unequal and oppressive society.
And final question. It's after 50 years, you know, since Bloody Sunday, what's the significance of the event when it comes to the movement for Irish republicanism today, and that you make reference to in your article?
It remains a very decisive event. Injustice the courage of the community and the courage of the families to keep pushing for justice. And a part of its legacy, I think, it did change a lot of things, including the British shifted increasingly, because it was such, you know, very hard to defend internationally what happened. They tended to shift to a policy to collusion with paramilitaries, loyalist paramilitary death squads, really. Mm. And a lot of this is dirty work instead. And that included attacks on random Catholic families, like they tended to target middle-class, respectable Catholics who had no Republican ties, in order to make the point that all Catholics needed to understand their place. And they would often just wipe out entire families doing that. I think that changed the nature of the struggle. I mean, I think one of the important things when we look at 50 years on was one of the decisive things in the Republican struggle that got to the stage of the Good Friday Agreement was the extent to which it was able to recover the political struggle, which really came around the prisoner struggle in the late 70s and into the 1981 hunger strike, where 10 Republican prisoners died on hunger strike fighting for the principle that they wanted political status, that we are political prisoners, we are not common criminals. And the international support that generated, exposing the British state and the courage of that, I think really showed the depth of support for the Republican movement, and really showed that they couldn't be militarily defeated at the same time as the IRA could not itself militarily defeat the British, and really lay the groundwork, I think, for a shift of political focus and a political strategy, which has led us to the situation today where you have a Good Friday Agreement, being much of which has never been implemented and has been badly undermined in many ways. I guess Brexit is a major thing in undermining, but there's plenty of other things as well. So it's a very, very fragile. The Northern Irish Assembly is sitting where it didn't for a few years. But it's still under British rule. And that means things like the austerity that happens in Northern Ireland is implemented by the Northern Irish Assembly, but the budget comes from London. They have no control over their own budget. You can see with the Brexit situation that majority of Northern Ireland voted against Brexit, but they have to live with it and the very potentially quite dire consequences it has for Northern Ireland, both economically and politically. And that's led to a situation where, you know, there was growing support for the question of Irish unification, and Sinn Féin, as a Republican party, is pushing quite hard on the campaign for a referendum that's allowed under the Good Friday Agreement, which would be an all Ireland referendum on Irish unity. And I think the fact that there's been no justice around things like Bloody Sunday feed very strongly into that. They can't even prosecute a single soldier for blatant murder, that even the British authorities now accept was blatant, unprovoked murder, and they can't even prosecute a single one. It really feeds very strongly into the argument when you connect it with everything else, including the underdevelopment of Northern Ireland, the poverty in Northern Ireland, that the issues that led to the civil rights struggle and itself led to the Troubles cannot be resolved without Irish unification, and there is a clear democratic way to achieve that.
All right. Well, we might have to we'll have to conclude that the interview on that note. But we'd like to thank you very much, Stuart, for being on our program today. I think it's been a very kind of like good kind of history lesson, especially in terms of its the significance of Bloody Sunday for Irish republicanism today. And yeah, I just recommend to our listeners that you can read Stuart's article on the Green Left website, which is titled Bloody Sunday, 50 Years On, A Symbol of Ongoing Injustice. But yeah, thanks again, Stuart.
Sure, thank you.
All right, we're just speaking to Stuart Monckton.